It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll be talking about modern quilting and learn about a century-old sewing circle in our state. First, a new state-mandated civics exam for Wisconsin high school students is getting its first test. The state legislature created the graduation requirement as part of the last biennial budget. Anissa Johnson is with us to talk about the test. She's an education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Anissa, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, what was the idea behind the new state-mandated civics tests that are going to go into effect next year?
So this was proposed by James Edming, a Republican lawmaker from Northwest Wisconsin, who felt that young people don't have enough of a grasp on their civics knowledge. It does model, or does seem to be modeled, on this national initiative by something called the Joe Foss Institute that is trying to get these into law in states around the country.
So in Wisconsin, tell us about who has to take it and what the stakes are as far as passing goes.
Well, high school seniors have to take it. They must pass it to graduate, which was one of the controversies around it. There is a sense that these, what they call high-stakes graduation tests, can be problematic for some students. There's some research to suggest that students are who might have difficulty passing a test, a graduation test, might drop out. I think there were about 13 groups that weighed in when this was before the legislature, and the only one that supported it was a group associated with this Joe Foss Institute. So.
And it sounds as though one of the issues with it, and it's not in effect yet, it goes into effect next year, but one of the issues has been the language, and it's being offered in different languages. Is that right?
Well, I only heard from MPS that they were doing it in different languages, which I thought was a brilliant decision. There are students who come into the United States, and English is not their primary language, and I thought it was a terrific effort to reach out to what is a very, very diverse community here in Milwaukee.
And there were some dissenting voices on this bill. Can you tell us a little bit about what opponents said going into it?
Well, I think the primary concerns had to do with, one, this requirement, this high-stakes testing requirement, this idea that students are tested significantly already, and also a lot of the critics would say that a test like this is just too simplistic to capture the complexities of civics knowledge, issues, topics like our democratic principles or American history.
Right. Well, as you say, the test has been rolled out in some school districts in Wisconsin so far, kind of as a trial balloon, it sounds like. How are students doing?
Well, it's a trial balloon, but it's also, my understanding is that this will count for those kids. So some schools are having all their kids take it. Some kids are all ninth through 11th grade take it. And if those kids passed it, they're good to go and to graduate when they're seniors. The programs that I spoke to, I thought, had excellent pass rates. MPS, I believe, said 86%. Some others, more affluent suburban districts, were in high 90%. So I got an email from a reader who said, well, that means the tests are too easy. Well, it's kind of the nature of the test. It's not an essay test.
Well, let's talk about the test itself. Where did the questions on this new civics test come from?
Well, they come from the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, and that is the agency that oversees naturalization of immigrants. And so what they have is a 100-question test that immigrants take, although they don't receive the whole 100 questions. They are asked orally up to 10 of the questions, and it's not a multiple choice. So the tests that the kids are taking in the schools have, at least the ones I, the schools I talked to, were all multiple choice questions. And so, depending on how hard you make the other choice options, those tests could be easier or harder. But generally, immigrants are asked such things as, what is an amendment? What do we call the first 10 amendments to the Constitution? What is one right or freedom from the First Amendment? And so on.
We're talking right now with Anissa Johnson, education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And she's joining us now to talk about the new state-mandated civics tests in Wisconsin going officially into effect next year. Some schools using those results already. And you've got a little sample of it, Anissa, up on the Journal Sentinel webpage, 20 questions. Does it give you, do you think, a good sense of what it's like to take this test?
Well, actually, we really wanted to do the 100. We wanted to do all 100. So I would say that little bitty sample doesn't really give you a good sense. I think it would have been fun to see how our general readers compared with the students and have them take the whole 100.
Well, it is interesting to see because you use the word fun there, and in your article you quote that some students think it is kind of fun taking it because you find out right away, you get immediate feedback, and the same is true on the Journal Sentinel sampling. I mean, is this a fun test to take, do you think?
Well, I took it before I even realized I was writing about it because I'd seen it. I had seen one of these sort of shorter versions circulating on Facebook, and I thought, I wonder how smart I am. So, I think those kind of tests are fun.
So there has been controversy surrounding students with disabilities taking this test. What's the issue there?
So when it was initially envisioned, the proposal said that students with disabilities would have to take the test, but they wouldn't have to pass it. Later, it was amended that students with individualized education plans, students with disabilities, could also opt out of taking it entirely. For disability rights activists or advocates and teachers who work with students with disabilities, they consider those kinds of things disrespectful. For one reason, there are many, many types of disabilities, many of which would have no bearing on a student's ability to take or pass a test like this. As one teacher put it, it really telegraphs that lawmakers have very low expectations for students with disabilities.
And what are teachers saying about the test so far, and administrators?
Well, they're very enthusiastic about the pass rate. I don't think anybody is happy that they have to add another test to the work that teachers are doing in the classroom. But I think they see it as the high scoring rates as vindication that what they're teaching in the classroom around civics, around the principles of democracy, around American history, are thorough and are being understood and picked up and by their students.
So given your reporting, the people that you spoke with in the Milwaukee area and beyond, do you think this test is teaching students things they didn't know already about the United States government?
Well, I don't know that the test itself is teaching these things. I think I guess I would concur with what the schools are saying, if kids know this stuff, it speaks to what's happening in the classroom.
Anissa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Anissa Johnson, education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joined us to talk about the new state-mandated civics test for high schoolers in Wisconsin. For more than a century, the women of the Swan Creek Sewing Circle have gathered on the first Wednesday of the month for Friendship and Good Works. Several longtime members, some for more than 50 years, tell us about the group and how it formed.
This is a prayer creed that we say each time we meet. Dear God, give us the grace to see the blessings that have come from Thee.
I'm Mary Kay Clark. I'm the current president. And the reason that I'm part of this amazing group is because the Swan Creek Sewing Circle was founded at my grandmother's home. at the time, her husband said, this will never last. So I think that's really inspired us all to keep it going.
On December 1st of 1915, a group of rural women from Fitchburg and Dunn Township met at the home of Amanda Culp with the idea of organizing a social club just to break the monotony of their everyday farm life. And they didn't just run to coffee like we do and meet at the nearest Panera or someplace. So 15 women were present at the first meeting in December, and then by February there were 30. And people ask, well, why do they call it Swan Creek? Since the club started in the Swan Creek School District, it seemed appropriate, they thought, to call it Swan Creek Sewing Circle. And the ladies decided at the first or second meeting that they would have the first Wednesday of each month, that's when they would meet, and that tradition has continued for 100 years, faithfully, from what I understand.
I remember when I was in grade school, my mother had an old gray bar sewing machine, it was called. It wasn't a pedal, but it was an electric one. And I would just watch her show, sew everything that she did. And I just loved it. And I gradually learned like that. And I think that's basically how the girls way back then, you know, picked up on that.
I recall watching my mother a lot. We had an old Singer treadle machine. Then she showed me how to sew a few things. So then when I got to high school, I remember as a freshman in homemaking class, we had, of course, I think we started out sewing pajamas, and I had to go to an electric machine. There were three of them, but I had to go to that one. And I remember stepping on that pedal so hard. And the sister was in charge of the class, and she said, Carol, just a minute. Hang on. This is an electric machine, not a treadle. So anyway, I learned in a hurry and got the pajamas made anyway.
Here we are.
It was
in 2009, the roll call was to bring your favorite apron and wear well. You know, I don't know how many of us even wear aprons anymore. Barb probably does. Barb says, kiss the cook.
I still have it, and many more, but I still wear an apron.
We still meet the first Wednesday of every month. Our dues are $3 a year. When we first started 100 years ago, they were 5 cents a meeting. So if someone, you know, made it to every meeting, that would have been 60 cents a year. So we've kept inflation under control that now we're just at $3 a year.
I've heard quite a few times that we could possibly be the only one in the country that has minutes. They're all marked from the very, very first meeting in 1915 all the way up till now.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. This past Saturday was National Quilting Day, and as a belated celebration, we'll listen back to a conversation Rob Ferret had with Wendy Franzak, former president of the Madison Modern Quilt Guild.
Wendy, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So what's the difference between a traditional and a modern quilt style?
Well, typically a modern quilt is inspired by modern design, so you would see it in a more contemporary home where a Civil War quilt may not fit in quite as nicely. You'll see, in some cases, a lot of negative space, maybe bold colors, a little bit more use of solid fabric versus prints, and there might be some improvisational piecing where things aren't quite as straight. We call it wonky. So,
is that a technical term?
I think it's a technical term. So things aren't quite as precise looking, but they still take a lot of time and love to create.
Now, when did this kind of modern quilting come into existence?
Well, modern quilting has really been around through most of the 20th century. Like, for example, G's Ben's quilts, I would call that modern quilting. But it really exploded when Martha Stewart had Denise Schmidt on her show in the late 90s, and she came out with an excellent book, Denise Schmidt Quilts, in 2005, and Weeks Ringel and Bill Kerr came out with an excellent book called Quilter Studio in that same time, and it really exploded in blogs and Flickr especially, and it really took off from there.
And is there really a super hard and fast distinctions? One person is a traditional quilter, one's a modern, or do some people play back and forth and maybe even mix styles?
Yeah, it really varies a lot from quilter to quilter. I think a lot of my personal work is more like fresh traditional, where it may be considered modern because of the colors being used, but I might use a lot of traditional blocks. But yeah, everyone has their own unique voice when it comes to quilting, just like modern art.
Well, quilting is really interesting because in some ways it's a solo gig, mm-hmm. and in some ways there's this community of quilting. What's our quilting community like here in the state?
Yeah, we're really lucky. We have a really strong quilting community, especially in Madison. We have both the Madison Modern Quilt Guild, which I'm a member of, and the Mad City Quilt Guild. And we get together and sew, we get together and show our work and get inspiration from each other. We also have Quilt Expo in September, which is
huge.
Huge. It's the Lollapalooza of quilting, where thousands of people come from all over the world to see quilting, buy quilts, and show their quilts.
And then I see quilting at county fairs, at state fair. Do we see modern quilts in those kind of settings?
Yeah, we're starting to creep into those areas. There's about 35% of the quilting market right now is modern, and we're starting to see even more than that in our local quilt shows.
Now, you mentioned Flickr, and the first reaction might be quilting and social media, traditional, modern, but has social media changed the world of quilting?
Yeah, it absolutely has. The Flickr group, Fresh Modern Quilts, really expanded modern quilting exponentially. That's where people could get together and see each other's work, and it's exploded from there. Instagram in particular is really huge. That's my favorite place to get inspiration. Facebook, blogs, yeah, social media is definitely influential in the spread of it.
So how does it, do you put, as you're working on something, maybe works in progress and post them up on social media?
Unfortunately for my friends and family, constantly. Yeah, on Instagram and
another
Facebook.
Quilt.
Yeah, another cat or quilt on Wendy's Instagram. Thanks.
Cats and quilts.
Yes, cats and quilts.
But is the cat a challenge? I mean, because I could see a cat really doing a lot of damage.
No. They're your favorite buddy in the quilt shop.
Okay.
Or in the quilt room.
With a resurgence in handmade artisan items, right? People like buying local and handmade things. Is there a bigger audience to maybe you want to buy a handmade modern quilt?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of local quilters that sell. My friend Nikki Ross sells her quilts on Etsy. Absolutely.
And what kind of things inspire your patterns, your designs?
I like to look to some of the great quilters like Jackie Gehring or Weeks Ringel for inspiration. Just improvisational piecing where you're kind of making your own fabric as you go along, I find very inspiring. Maybe modern art in some cases, and just looking at the quilting community in general for inspiration.
Now, when I think of quilting, I think of, you know, some math in there, and you got to come in with a plan and know what's going to fit where. And you're saying improvisational. How does that work?
Yeah, that's kind of, some people are into it, some people are not, but for the math part, I'm not always the best at. So with improvisational piecing, you don't have to cut quite as precisely or even sew as precisely. In some cases, I'll definitely get some flack for saying that. But for me, it's more freeform sewing.
But you still end up with a rectangle. You're not, because I would end up with like little triangles poking out all over the place.
Well,
three-dimensional weirdness.
Yeah, three-dimensional weirdness, exactly. That's where rulers and rotary cutters come into place. You can square things up with that at the end.
And another thing I think of with the internet is it's got to open you up to having a lot more resources in terms of your fabric selection. Mm-hmm. Even either you're going out and ordering yourself or your local quilt shop has access to more fabrics, maybe from around the world. Is this true?
Yeah, actually, I just purchased some fabric from England this week. But we do have a lot of really awesome local quilt shops like Stitcher's Crossing or Millhouse. But there's a lot of online resources where you can buy quilt fabric from Japan or any of your friends on Instagram. Even you can buy fabric.
What got you into quilting?
I really needed a need to create. I was working about 50 hours or so a week, and I really just needed something to do that wasn't a responsibility involving my family or my work life. So I just searched around for a quilt shop that had a class that met my needs, and I found one.
What's the easiest way? Say somebody's thinking, yeah, I'd be into this. I don't want to put a lot of money into it up front in case it's my thing, not my thing. What's a good entry-level way to get to taste quilting?
Yeah, it can be definitely expensive to get started. I would recommend either a class through your local quilt shop where you can borrow supplies, or Madison College even offers sewing machines that you can use during their quilting classes.
Seems like just finding a friend who quilts and being their co-pilot for a little bit. And do people do that? Do you kind of apprentice and watch how it's done and then figure out how to do it?
Yeah, absolutely. And people come to the Madison Modern Quilt Guild to learn, too, and they can do that at our sew days.
Now, you mentioned a couple famous quilters when you go to the ginormous quilt expo here. Do you get to meet some of these legends in the field?
Yes. Well, Nancy Zeman does quilt expo here, so we're really lucky for that. But yeah, that's one of the most exciting parts, to meet the quilt rock stars, like we call them.
Okay. I got to know what you're working on. How many projects do you have in progress right now?
At least six.
Six?
Yes.
Okay.
I have 10 completed, six in progress.
And what's your favorite one? What's the most fun one that you wish you weren't talking to me so you could be working on it right now?
Yes, I will leave the studio and work on a modern quilt inspired by Jackie Gehring. It's improv, gray and white. I hope to have it in the Sun Prairie Quilt Show.
Okay, gray and white, improv, what kind of patterns will we look like?
Squares with white sticks in it. Doesn't sound too amazing over radio.
Well, send us a picture.
I will. Thank you.
Well, Wendy, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
All right. Thank you so much.
That's Central Times Rob Farah talking to Wendy Franczak, former president of the Madison Modern Quilt Guild. They were talking about modern versus traditional quilting. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll look at a new report about opioid deaths in Milwaukee County. First, a recent study found that expanding certain state gun control laws nationwide could drastically cut back on the amount of firearm deaths in the country. The report from Boston University School of Public Health says that laws like background checks for purchases of guns and ammunition, as well as making firearms traceable, are among the most effective ways to lower gun deaths. The authors of the study even go so far as to say that if these three laws were adopted nationwide, gun-related deaths would drop by 80%. But do these studies have any effect on the enactment of gun control laws and the current state of that debate? Adam Winkler joins us now. He's a professor of law at UCLA and the author of the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Adam, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So in general, how much do studies like this one have on the overall gun debate in America?
Well, I don't think that these studies have a tremendous impact today because it's so ideologically driven. People who are opposed to gun control, really not that open-minded about what studies show with regards to public safety, and often many people who are opposed to guns tend to close their eyes to these kinds of studies as well. But I think the more and more studies we get, the more people in the middle will really start to be persuaded that certain kinds of gun control laws can work, but also that certain kinds of gun control laws that are very popular really won't work and that we should move beyond them.
Well, do we have enough data about what works and what might not work as well when it comes to preventing gun deaths?
We really don't, and in part that's because there's been very few studies on the effectiveness of gun safety prevention legislation. There have been some, but for the most part, given the fact that about 30,000 people a year lose their lives to gun violence, very, very few studies relative to that number. In part, that's because the Center for Disease Control, which is one of the biggest funders of studies into public health problems, has been shut down as a method of financing gun research. The NRA and its allies in Congress some years ago passed a law that said that the CDC could not use any of its funding to promote gun control studies. And ever since then, both the CDC and the National Institutes of Health, which finances a lot of research into public health problems, have sort of stayed away from gun control issues for fear of losing funding.
Well, given that, how does an electorate make informed decisions about how to prevent gun violence?
Well, I think that's very difficult to do without good information. Instead, what we end up doing is relying on bad information. And so we see this a lot in the gun area. There's been a very popular study that has been influential and does suggest, maybe as your first question asked, that maybe some people can be swayed by these studies, which is the very well-known More Guns, Less Crime studies of John Lott that seem to suggest that if you made it easier for people to carry guns on the streets, then we see the rates of violent crime go down. Those studies have been significantly challenged, however, and very few few social scientists believe those studies are really reliable, but they've really informed the gun debate so far.
So looking specifically again at this new study from Boston University saying that if there were universal background checks, if the gun and the ammunition were traceable to the owner, then the death rate would drop significantly. Based on what you've seen, is that a reasonable conclusion that maybe has been duplicated elsewhere?
Well, this was sort of a study of studies where they tried to get as much information had been as many studies has been promoted and published before, and tried to analyze all that data. And they analyzed a whole bunch of different kinds of gun control laws, and it had a little bit to offer for both sides of the gun debate. It found that there were many gun laws that actually were not associated with reductions in mortality, and did find a few like universal background checks and ammunition. Identification and background checks when you bought ammunition to be associated with reductions in mortality. I'm not sure that the study's findings that it would lead to something like an 80% drop in mortality rates if we had federal background checks really passes the smell test, but that's what the numbers led these social scientists to conclude. And as good social scientists, you go where the numbers take you.
And you did say earlier that it did find that some popular laws were not so effective. Which laws were you talking about?
Well, for instance, take something like bans on assault weapons. These have become very popular. In fact, you might consider them one of the biggest agenda items in the gun control movement's agenda today, which is to ban the sale of these military-style assault rifles. And the study found that actually where states banned assault weapons, it was actually associated with increases in mortality. And why that might be the case, we might think, is that people generally don't bring rifles around to create criminal activity, and if you do, you tend to have to hide them very well. But a handgun's real easy to conceal, and it may be that if you're banned from having that rifle, you're going to take the handgun, and you may be even more likely to use it.
We're talking right now with Adam Winkler, professor of law at UCLA, and the author of the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. We're taking as a starting point a new study from Boston University that says by having universal background checks, the gun mortality rate would drop by 80%. Also, some other measures included in that. And Adam, looking at some of the things you've said in the past about gun rights and gun control philosophies, you said they can coexist, and they have done so in the past. How would you gauge the current temperature in the debate over gun laws?
Well, it seems pretty fever pitch right now, right? There's no doubt that the gun debate is very, very rife with anger, recrimination, a lack of trust on both sides. But I do think that we have a society today where we have a right to bear arms, but we also have gun control laws on the books, and we've always had gun control laws on the books. And I think what we need to do is find that place in the middle where we can, both sides can come to agreement, where we can agree that, yes, people do have a right to have guns in their home for personal protection, but also that things like universal background checks, to do everything we can to keep guns out of the hands of criminals and the mentally ill, are not only constitutionally permissible, but good, sound policies that everyone should support. But it's going to take a while before we find that moderate middle. We're certainly not there now.
Now, you look at this Boston University study. They're saying there could be an 80% drop in gun mortality rates if these, if things like universal background checks are adopted. That's one, tracing the ownership back and the ammunition, tracing those, that's another. You said that didn't pass the sniff test for you. Why not?
Well, it's not that, it just seems like the numbers seem outrageously large to think that we're going to drop 80% by just having background checks when we already have 320 million guns in circulation in America. It just doesn't seem like that number can actually be right. Now, granted, that's what the numbers of the social scientists, that's what they found, but it's really just a prediction, and it seems to me that prediction would be off just because we already have so many guns in our country, and that it's pretty easy at this point in time for a criminal to get their hands on guns, even if you have universal background checks. So I think we should expect more modest reductions in crime, but we should see some reductions nonetheless.
How controversial are universal background checks today?
Well, as you may recall, that after the Newtown shooting in December of 2012, President Obama made a big push to get a new federal law requiring universal background checks adopted. And he was not able to get that law adopted because of opposition in some circles. And so I think it is still controversial whether you get it. I think one of the reasons why President Obama's proposals were knocked down was for fear that it would lead to the federal government creating a gun registry. But I think that could easily be avoided by well-drafted legislation that eases the concerns of the NRA on those issues.
And who would be drafting that legislation? Is there a political will to do something like that?
You know what? There is a political will among some to do it, but I think that there is no one who really believes that such a law could get through the Senate or through the House at this moment in time. You know, we're going to have an election in November, and that election may change the composition of the House and may change the composition of the Senate, which might lead to a different political calculus. But these things are long-term problems. They're not short-term problems, and that what proponents on both sides of this issue should be doing is focusing on the long-term fight for what they believe in. That's where you're going to make some accomplishments, probably not in the next year or two.
We're talking with Adam Winkler right now about the current state of the country's debate over gun control, and you can join the conversation. Would you be in favor of a state or a national law like the ones we're talking about if they could be proven to drastically reduce gun deaths, as the study from Boston University says? Do you like the idea of universal background checks for guns or ammunition buyers, or being able to trace weapons back to their owner? And if you're opposed to these kinds of laws, would anything make you change your mind? You can let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We're taking a look at a new study from Boston University that found background checks and making a gun traceable to its owner are especially effective at reducing gun deaths. And you can join our conversation. Would you be in favor of a state law like this, a national like this, like the ones we're talking about, suggested by Boston University? Do you like the idea of background checks for guns and ammunition buyers? And if you're not on board with these laws, what do you think you would propose to reduce gun mortality? Call 800-642-1234, and UCLA law professor Adam Winkler stays with us now. We go first to Todd, joining us from Baraboo. Hi, Todd.
Hello. It seems like the big hang-up is that gun ownership is a right that's, or gun possession is a right that's guaranteed in the Constitution. Well, we also have a right to free speech. But there's any number of things that if I were to post on the Internet, the government would and probably should come down pretty hard on me. How is the right of free speech, the limitations put on that, any different than the sensible limitations that can be put on gun ownership?
Todd, thanks for that. And Adam, what about that?
It's a great point, and it's a great response to those people who say the Second Amendment says the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, and that means that you can't have gun control laws. And the truth of the matter is none of our constitutional rights are absolute. The Supreme Court has said, yes, you have the right to free speech, but that right to free speech can be limited. It can be limited. For instance, you have a right to free speech. You don't get to go into a courtroom while it's in session and start declaring your support for Donald Trump or for Hillary Clinton. It's just not an appropriate vehicle, and if the government has sufficiently strong reasons to limit your speech in a particular place, they can do so. And the same thing with regards to guns, and the Supreme Court made clear in its Heller decision in 2008, where the court specifically held there was a right of individuals to keep and bear arms, that the right was not absolute, and that laws banning felons from having guns, or the mentally ill from having guns, or restricting guns in sensitive places like government buildings or schools were still constitutionally permissible. And it's an important lesson for all of us to learn. No rights are absolute.
Todd, appreciate that call. And we'll go back to Cody in Madison now. Cody, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to say?
I was just a little interested. I kind of want to start off by saying, I'm all for sensible gun control because I kind of know a little bit more than some people, I guess. I know that background checks, for instance, aren't permanent. They do them nationally and then they get rid of them. But I was more interested, these studies always look at and they say, you know, there's 30,000 to 40,000 deaths a year. And A lot of those deaths are actually suicides. Like, actually looking at the CDC report, it was almost two-thirds of the deaths are suicides. And I'm just kind of wondering, how could, especially since most people who commit suicide are able to pass a background check and legally buy ammunition and guns, how could some of these common sense laws actually change that?
Cody, appreciate the call, and Cody bringing up whether or not the numbers are skewed a little bit, not taking into account suicides. What do you say to that, Adam?
Well, it's a great point. We have to remember that Cody's right. About two-thirds of all gun deaths every year are suicides. Suicides are a different phenomenon than, say, school shootings or normal criminal homicide, and probably requires different answers than trying to stop criminal gun violence. I will say that the study that you're talking about from The Lancet was careful to distinguish the effect on suicide versus homicide, and looked at these various different gun control laws and how they might affect both homicide and suicide. So the researchers are attentive to that difference, and it's one that perhaps we need to be more attentive to as people discuss public policy.
Cody, appreciate that call at 800-642-1234. And we're going to go next to Jan, joining us in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Jan.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Well, I'm a lifelong Democrat, and I'm from a small town in Illinois. And I was recently chatting on Facebook with a couple of men from my hometown. One lives in Texas, one lives in Louisiana. And the amount of anger and rage towards Democrats was unbelievable. Like, saying statements like, all Democrats want to take away our guns. And it was like, wait. And I would write to them, I'm a Democrat, and I'm not trying to take away your guns. I want really common sense gun control.
Jan, appreciate that call. Jan, getting at how difficult it can be just to talk about this, let alone agree on any sort of policy. Why do you think it is that this is, of all the issues out there, why is this such a polarizing one?
Well, that's such a great question, and it is very polarizing, and in part because I think people have very, very different understandings of how to reduce gun crime. I mean, I think there's a lot of people who believe the best thing we can do to reduce gun deaths is to get rid of guns. And there's a bunch of people in our country who believe the exact opposite, that they think the best way to reduce gun crime is to have more guns, and that if you have more guns, then people won't assault other people on the street for fear that they're going to assault someone who has a gun and who will shoot them. And when you have such different worldviews, it's really hard to come to that middle ground. I also think that in the gun world, we've seen the NRA and others continually promote the idea that any form of gun control is really just a slippery slope towards total gun confiscation, and that even someone like President Obama, who, whether he may be anti-gun or whatnot, if you believe that, has never come out in support of taking away anyone's guns since he's been president, has never promoted any such policy, has specifically said he supports the Heller decision that recognized a right to bear arms, and yet the NRA continually runs against him, saying that he has got a 10-point plan to take away our guns. I think we're going to see the same thing about Hillary, too, who's not promoting the idea of gun confiscation, but nonetheless, I'm sure she'll be accused of doing just that in this coming election.
And Adam, as we get ready to wrap up here, we've got a nominee from President Obama, Merrick Garland, to the Supreme Court. If he were to be nominated, which seems, you know, anyone can say it's not likely per se, but it's not out of the question. How would that, do you think, influence the gun control debate?
Well, you know, he would be replacing on the Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, who wrote the Heller decision in 2008 and has been a big, strong backer on the Supreme Court for expansive understandings of our constitutional right to bear arms. Presumably, Judge Garland would not have necessarily that same broad view. There are those who believe that if Judge Garland gets on the court, that would mean there's five justices who are prepared to overturn the Heller case. I don't think that's quite right. I'm not really sure that the liberals on the court are eager to upset the right to bear arms, in part because the Heller decision has not really prevented most state and local governments from enacting good and effective gun control laws. And even just today, the court, in a per curiam opinion, overturned a decision in Massachusetts that held that stun guns were not protected by the Second Amendment. And all the justices joined that opinion, suggesting that even the liberal justices are not as hostile to the Second Amendment and to the Heller case as one might imagine.
And we leave it there. Adam, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was UCLA Law Professor Adam Winkler talking about how studies and statistics can influence our debate over gun control laws. A new study from Boston University shows background checks and the requirement to make guns traceable to their owner are the most effective laws when it comes to gun policy.